today on Against the Grain, mass attitudes toward LGBTQ people and gay rights shifted dramatically in the U.S. beginning in the late 1980s. What explains the rapid and sustained shift in the pro-gay direction? I'm CS. Jeremiah Gerritsen joins me to discuss his new book, The Path to Gay Rights, How Activism and Coming Out Changed Public Opinion, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You could call it a seismic shift in mass attitudes and popular opinion. Polls show a dramatic transformation of the U.S. public's views on gay rights in the direction of greater tolerance of LGBTQ people and greater support of LGBTQ rights. So when and how did this happen? What explains the phenomenal success of the LGBTQ movement at changing public attitudes? What role did activism and news reporting and TV shows and LGBTQ people coming out and pro-gay statements by political elites? What role did all or any of this play in transforming mass opinion? Jeremiah Gerritsen explores these issues in his new book. It's called The Path to Gay Rights, How Activism and Coming Out Changed Public Opinion. Jeremiah is Assistant Professor of Political Science at California State University, East Bay. When Jeremiah Gerritsen joined me recently in studio, I asked him about how the magnitude of the shift in popular attitudes toward gay rights compared with other shifts in mass opinion historically.
So it's probably similar to the shifts in mass opinion that we've seen on race in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, on into the 70s. It's probably similar to attitudes that have changed towards the proper roles of men and women in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But the real difference is that the change that took place on LGBTQ issues, particularly in the 1990s, was much more well documented by the polling industry. There was just an order of magnitude more data that we could look at and document this shift.
How big of a change in popular attitudes are we talking about?
I would say probably 35 to 40% of the public was tolerant of LGBTQ people. And I pick that word tolerant very specifically. They tolerated LGBTQ people, but they didn't necessarily have positive feelings towards LGBTQ people. So 35 to 40% were expressing some support for LGBTQ rights, maybe in principle.
In what year?
We're talking up to about the early 80s. Now, fast forward to today, we have two-thirds of the nation in support of same-sex marriage, and we also have much greater positivity towards LGBTQ people, particularly lesbians and gays. And I would say that probably a third of the public, a third, one out of every three, has changed over the past 20 to 25 years on this one specific issue.
And that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've gone from having roughly about a third of the public tolerant to about two-thirds of the public in pretty solid support of LGBTQ rights, at least when it comes to issues like same-sex marriage or gays in the military or same-sex adoption or things like that.
Okay. So, you know, a shift in popular attitudes is one thing. Explaining that shift is another. What are the theories of why attitudes toward LGBTQ people and issues in the U.S. change or changed? What are the theories that you are pushing back against in this book?
So some of the most popular theories in political science implicate television news. So various things happen in the news, they're covered in the news, and they change people's attitudes. One of these is the endorsements of political elites. So for instance, Bill Clinton in the early 1990s was the first Democratic presidential nominee who was fairly supportive of gay rights. And in political science, we would expect that if a political leader, for instance, Clinton as the leader of the Democratic Party, endorsed gay rights, that ordinary Democrats or the followers of Clinton in the public would start to bring their attitudes in line. They trust Clinton's judgment on this issue. They might not think about the issue that much, but they trust that Clinton has thought through the issue, and they tend to adopt the attitudes of their elites. Another big way in which attitudes are thought to be changed in political science and communication involve framing effects. So sympathetic reporters can include various frames in a story. They could talk about a story in a specific way that will affect people's attitudes. So for instance, you can construct a story on gay rights where you talk about sin and how gays are sinful and millennia of sinful behavior, or that has been the interpretation for millennia. Or you could talk about how gays are a minority seeking out equal rights and equal treatment, just like every other minority group in the United States. So framing effects and these elite signaling effects have been the dominant theories in political science as to why we've seen attitude change. So those are the theories that I've really pushed back against the most in terms of this book right here.
Are you saying those theories are not supported by the evidence?
I'm saying there's a number of different things, different data points that if you look at and you think about them, they really don't match up to the structure and the magnitude of the attitude change that we've seen in LGBTQ issues. So, for instance, if you look at the time periods when there was a lot of news coverage of LGBTQ issues, so Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 1993, Lawrence versus Texas when same-sex relationships were decriminalized in the early 2000s, you actually find that when that coverage took place, attitudes towards LGBTQ people on these specific issues actually grew more negative. We see, for instance, also that you would suspect, based on these theories, that people that consumed more news would be more likely to have shifted more positive towards LGBTQ people. That's actually not the case. It's actually the people that watched no television news that shifted the most over the last 20 to 25 years. And I think the real nail in the coffin is one very prominent finding from the public opinion literature on change in LGBTQ issues. Young people have shifted the most. And we know that younger people, particularly millennials, have been, up till a few years ago, the group least likely to consume the news. So in a number of different points, the structure of attitude change that we've seen on LGBTQ issues over the last 25 years has just not matched up with a theory or with a change mechanism that's being caused by television news or hard news in general.
So what then are you putting forward in this book as a better framework for understanding the shift in attitudes toward gay rights?
So I think the explanation that really matches the data and it just pops out of the data I've been analyzing is sort of the following sequence. Now, the news media had an effect, but it didn't really have a direct effect that was durable on people's attitudes. The real way the news media had an effect and the coverage of LGBTQ issues in the early 90s at the end of the AIDS crisis had an effect was to signal to LGBTQ people through Clinton's endorsements, through Don't Ask, Don't Tell, through supportive elites, that they were less stigmatized in society, that LGBTQ people were valued in society. And it was this message transmitted through the media that made LGBTQ people in general much more likely to share themselves and their preferences with other people. And it was through this sharing with other people that durable attitude change occurred in the public. And it tends to match up with the evidence in a much more persuasive way than the argument that this news media affected people directly.
But is it still the news media? In other words, was the news media making people think that there was less stigmatization and therefore they could come out, and then that fed into the processes you've discussed or you're discussing in this book?
Exactly. I think if you start to look at what's going on in the early 1990s, and all of these trends started pretty definitely in the early 1990s, that there was something that took place then that made LGBTQ people come out at much greater rates than they had in the past. And the only explanation that seems to fit is that there was this burst of news attention, particularly at the end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s. And I'm going to give a few events real quick. So the most prominent thing is coverage of the AIDS crisis and particularly AIDS activism, including groups like ACT UP. ACT UP consciously lobbied and coerced and did everything they could to get the news media, particularly the news media situated in New York City, to cover the AIDS crisis. And they were largely successful in doing that. And it was their activism that got covered that caught the attention of political leaders, especially in the Democratic Party. So we start to see in the early 1990s that lots of Democrats that didn't represent urban areas, for instance, like Bill Clinton, started to endorse gay rights. And my hypothesis is this is an active strategy to get individuals who were active in fighting AIDS to start to donate and participate in their campaigns. So we see Clinton endorse gay rights in 1992. We see Clinton also campaign in a very pro-gay fashion, especially to LGBTQ people. And we also see a year later, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a huge amount of coverage of LGBTQ issues in terms of the Democrats being depicted as being more supportive, even though Clinton really backtracked on Don't Ask, Don't Tell during that time period. Now, in that same time period, we also start to see, in response to this coverage of LGBTQ issues, fictional portrayals of LGBTQ people starting to be portrayed in fiction. And I think the first real major one was Tom Hanks in Philadelphia. And Tom Hanks in Philadelphia represented the beginning of a large number of depictions that would take place and grow much more prominent over the course of the 1990s of LGBTQ people in culture. A few years later, we would see Ellen DeGeneres on her show. We would see gay-themed episodes of the show Roseanne and Seinfeld in the 1990s. And it all goes back to Philadelphia, to that burst of news attention in 1992 and 1993. And also, that goes back to ACT UP. And it was all of this media that snowballed into more positive perceptions of the climate, of the national climate on LGBTQ issues that were perceived by LGBTQ people that helped them come out.
Jeremiah Gerritsen is his name. He's assistant professor of political science at California State University, East Bay. And his new book is The Path to Gay Rights, How Activism and Coming Out Changed Public Opinion. It's published by NYU Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you said a lot right there, Jeremiah, and I kind of want to pick it apart a little bit because you go into some detail about pretty much everything you just said in your book. So the AIDS crisis, so are you saying that the political activism among the LGBTQ community that was perhaps a response to the AIDS crisis, that without that kind of activism and specifically the activism of ACT UP, there would not have been the pressure on media to start covering lesbian and gay issues in the way they did?
Oh, definitely. I don't think there's any doubt of that. I mean, if you start to look at what was sort of going on, we have the Stonewall riots in the transition between the 60s and the 70s, and we have LGBT communities form in the nation's urban centers. But there's really no national coverage of LGBTQ people. Many people don't even know that LGBTQ people exist across the country because they're not being covered in the national media. And it took the AIDS crisis and the formation of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, to get the news media to cover first AIDS, then LGBTQ issues more generally. And it took that for sympathetic politicians to endorse gay rights. And it was that whole constellation of things that led to the normalization of depictions of LGBTQ people on television and movies and popular culture. So I think it's pretty conclusive that without the AIDS crisis, to normalize that national coverage, we wouldn't have seen all of the changes that we saw in the 1990s and the 2000s. They might have been delayed until the start of social media much later, but we certainly wouldn't have seen as much attitude change in the magnitude that we did in the 1990s and 2000s had it not been for the AIDS crisis and the response of the LGBTQ community to the AIDS crisis.
If we look at ACT UP's targeting of journalists and media producers, how unusual was that for LGBTQ activists? And what kind of strategies did they employ in order to get positive media coverage of gay and lesbian issues?
So the tactics that they used were very unconventional at the time. Now, one of the points I want to make is that there are actually a lot of gay reporters, lesbian reporters, in lots of these news organizations, for instance, the New York Times, but they were completely closeted. They didn't want to open themselves up potentially to employment discrimination, to getting fired, by advocating for coverage of LGBTQ issues. So there was no normalized coverage, and the people that could advocate for that normalized coverage felt so much stigma that they couldn't do it themselves. Now, what AIDS did is it brought people with very politically savvy skills into the LGBTQ movement because their lives were on the line. They would be dead in a few years if they couldn't get this coverage normalized. So you had people with public relations experience join ACT UP and become gay rights activists who wouldn't have become gay rights activists had it not been for the AIDS crisis. And they specifically targeted organizations, for instance, like the New York Times. Now, some of the tactics that they would engage in were quite innovative. They would engage in an insider-outsider strategy, as Larry Kramer, who helped found ACT UP and Gay Men's Health Crisis, described in some of his oral histories. So an insider-outsider strategy, you would have ACT UP outside of the organization, for instance, engaging in a quite unruly zap or a quite unruly bit of movement activity. They would be mean. They would harass people. They would engage in die-ins on Wall Street, for instance. They would try to take over the FDA. They would be very confrontational. But you'd also have a group that would take an insider strategy, and they would negotiate with the decision makers within these organizations, within the FDA. And it was really that dual insider-outsider strategy that was very effective for ACT UP for the first few years that ACT UP was engaging in activism up until about 1992. And the reason why is because you had sort of the unruly people outside, but you had the same people that would negotiate with them, telling the decision makers, you want to work with us, you don't want to work with those people outside.
So you were saying that as more LGBTQ people consumed media with positive messages or at least impartial coverage of lesbian and gay community issues and the AIDS crisis, that more of them began to come out. I'm wondering, you know, what are the statistics on that? Like, what do we know about the rates at which people came out in the late 80s and early 90s and through the 90s?
So I actually have some statistics on that in my book. And for instance, if you look at the Pew poll, you find that, you know, between 20 to 30% of people reported knowing LGBTQ people in the mid-1980s. Fast forward to 1995, the Newsweek poll actually shows between 40 and 50% of people knowing LGBTQ people on surveys. Move forward to 2005, Pew reports about 70% of people knowing LGBTQ people. So that's a huge shift in terms of any reported exposure to a minority group. You're going from really 25% or 30% up to about 70% in the span of 15 years. And that really encapsulates the stigma that LGBTQ people felt in the 1980s and prior. It was that stigma that was keeping people in the closet. And as soon as the media started to signal that that stigma wasn't quite as intense, you had this boom, this explosion of people coming out.
And I see that you have statistics here about the average age of coming out in the 70s and early 80s, as opposed to the average age of coming out in 1999.
Right. So the average age of coming out precipitously dropped across the course of the 1990s. I think the average age of coming out was probably a few years into college, maybe being a college junior or a college senior in the 80s and prior. Fast forward to the late 1990s, the average age of coming out probably dropped to the start of high school. And if we fast forward to today, the average age of coming out has probably even dropped below high school into junior high or middle school. And that also encapsulates the reduction of stigma that we've seen over the years through the normalization of depictions of LGBTQ people.
Did this national media attention to lesbian and gay issues have more of an impact on lesbian and gay folks in rural areas that didn't have a kind of established activist presence?
That's definitely my perception. I've been looking for a lot of hard data on this. I haven't come across that much hard data on this. But my perception is that the mechanisms that sort of undergirded this destigmatization that LGBTQ people felt were very much centered in the nation's urban areas prior to the 1990s. So for instance, you might be a sexual minority, you might be same-sex attracted, you might feel compelled, for instance, to move to the Bay Area or move to the New York City area. And there you would encounter other LGBTQ people. You would encounter LGBT community organizations as early as the late 60s, most definitely the 1970s, early 1980s. And you would start to feel more open. You would start to come out to other people. But if you were living in a rural area or a suburban area or a medium-sized city, you didn't encounter those LGBT groups that had formed. You didn't encounter and participate in the LGBTQ community culture, for instance. So it was really the destigmatization of media that was so impactful for LGBTQ people living across the country. It was through television or through radio or through movies that people that were LGBTQ that did not interact with other LGBTQ people on a regular basis because they were living in rural areas or suburban areas, that they learned what being LGBTQ was. And that's why they started coming out.
During the AIDS crisis, wouldn't people who were considering coming out, didn't they also have to consider the stigma that they would encounter?
Exactly. So there was a lot of stigma of LGBTQ people rising significantly during the 1980s. I mean, if I don't know how many of your listeners will remember Rock Hudson and Rock Hudson coming out and all the stigma around that.
The actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The stigma around people thinking that you can get AIDS from a toilet seat in the mid-1980s. All of this misinformation about how AIDS was spread. Individuals who worked in hospitals wouldn't want to handle the bodies of people that had AIDS because they were afraid that they would catch it. They wouldn't want to, you know, take the bodies to a crematorium or something like that. Just horrible, horrible stories. But while that stigma was very high through the late 1980s and early 1990s, it started to drop off a little after 1992, 1993. And when new medications started coming out, for instance, the triple cocktail in 1996, that signaled that AIDS was no longer sort of a death sentence, we started to see that among the public, particularly, that individuals who thought that they were worried about catching AIDS, that sort of uncoupled from opposition to gay rights. It didn't look like there was as big an impact in the late 1990s about people worrying about catching AIDS negatively impacting their support for gay rights. So what I think happened was we started to see that stigma wear off in the 1990s, and that also intensified the coming out. And a lot of these coming out trends, they're not that intense in the early 90s, 92, 93, 94, when a lot of this coverage is happening, but they grow more intense around the rest of the 1990s, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99. It's really the late 90s that the coming out boom had happened. And I think part of that coming out boom was a delay as the stigma from AIDS started to wear off. And we also started to see many more positive depictions. I think the dividing line there is Ellen DeGeneres. When Ellen DeGeneres' show came out, I think that sort of signified a lot that the destigmatization was starting to work its way through.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jeremiah Gerritsen joins me. His book is The Path to Gay Rights, How Activism and Coming Out Changed Public Opinion. He teaches political science at California State University, East Bay. So we've been talking a lot about coming out, but your book is about mass attitudes. And a lot of these masses are not people who are coming out and, in fact, not gay or lesbian or bisexual folks at all. So we will get to the media portrayals of gays and lesbians, but I want to stick with this idea that, and you've already broached this subject, so more people coming out, there's more interpersonal contact, right? So there's more contact that people have who are not gay with people who are. But I guess part of that issue is who people come out to, right? So tell us about the contours of the contact that results from the interpersonal contact that results from people coming out.
Okay, so I think contact's more powerful if it involves a closer relationship between the two people that are interacting. So for instance, if it's a friend or family member, it's going to be much more powerful than an acquaintance or a coworker that you only interact with marginally. Really, what gives intergroup contact its power is if the two individuals who are interacting, if there's no what we call status differentials, if there's no, if it's not a, as long as it's not like an employee and a boss interacting. And the thing that's really advantaged LGBTQ people is that they are born into heterosexual families. So were LGBTQ people in general very well integrated, and they tend to interact with people in ways that don't have these status differentials. So that has made intergroup contact with LGBTQ people much more effective at changing people's attitudes than, for instance, intergroup contact between racial outgroups and in-groups, because there's going to be that perception of a status differential. There's going to be class differences baked into that interaction that make the intergroup contact be less efficacious in changing people's attitudes. And because it's really interacting without these status differentials that make the intergroup contact more effective, LGBTQ people end up becoming more effective at changing people's attitudes the more similar they are to the person they're interacting with. So if it's a friend, you're pretty similar to your friends usually. If it's a family member, you're very similar to your family members usually. So the closer the relationship, the closer the quality of the relationship, the more effective this this intergroup contact or this interpersonal influence is. Now, there are a few subgroups where intergroup contact is actually not very effective. There are a few demographic groups where coming out doesn't necessarily have a positive effect. In fact, it can actually have a backlash effect and a lower support for gay rights. And those groups are individuals that are very religiously or politically ideological. It's ideology and challenging someone's ideological beliefs where we can start to have these backlash effects. So, for instance, if someone's a member of a religious faith that incorporates as part of their doctrine anti-gay beliefs or anti-gay rights positions, or if individuals are very, very politically conservative and structure their identity around their political conservativeness, I actually find that if those individuals meet LGBTQ acquaintances or coworkers, it actually starts to trigger a process called motivated reasoning. So individuals who are very, very politically conservative, part of being very, very politically conservative is not supporting same-sex marriage or things like that. If they meet an LGBTQ person, that positive contact starts to challenge that belief a little. And it's the challenging of that conservative belief against same-sex marriage that starts to bring up some cognitive dissonance in these individuals. Conservatives don't want to have their beliefs challenged on these issues because that's very discomforting. And what will start to happen is they'll start to mentally counter-argue. Think of all the reasons they shouldn't support same-sex marriage and bring those to the top of their head when their beliefs start to get challenged like that. And they can actually become less pro-gay in terms of their survey responses in the presence of this positive intergroup contact. So there are very few individuals where intergroup contact does not appear to be effective. Very, very ideologically conservative individuals, very, very religiously conservative individuals. And unfortunately, these are the people that tend to be the decision makers nowadays in terms of public policy. So this is why the public has grown much more supportive. But because, you know, virtually every elected Republican is a solid conservative nowadays, ironically, that hasn't led to political change, to changes in law, for instance. It's still legal to discriminate in terms of employment in most states. In fact, among Republicans in Congress, they've actually grown less supportive of LGBTQ rights as they polarized more conservative. So we used to have more moderately conservative Republicans from the Northeast in Congress. As they've lost re-election, the Republicans in Congress have actually grown less pro-gay over the last 15 years or so.
Let's talk more about the portrayals of gays and lesbians on TV. How frequently were gays and lesbians portrayed on TV before the mid-1980s?
Oh, before the mid-1980s, I would say they were almost never portrayed. And if they were portrayed, it was, I'm thinking there might have been like one or two portrayals in that time period. So for instance, there might have been a character who was a villain on One Life to Live or something like that, or some other soap opera. There's one exception. And that exception is All in the Family. All in the Family actually had a very pro-gay episode in the 1970s, just completely out of its time. But All in the Family was very ahead of its time. So I would say there's very few, almost no depictions of, especially in terms of regular positive depictions of LGBTQ people in the 70s and 80s. In fact, many people probably didn't know that LGBTQ people even existed in the 70s and 80s, which might be surprising for a lot of younger people today.
So what happened to the number of portrayals over the course of the 1990s?
Going into the 1990s, we still had a very low level of portrayals of LGBTQ people. It was really in the early 1990s, around the time of Philadelphia, the movie Philadelphia, starring Tom Hanks that I mentioned before, which depicted a character who was facing employment discrimination because he had AIDS, that we started to see more and more studio executives and writers starting to get their feet wet with LGBTQ issues. So the first thing that started to happen is around, again, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that time when Bill Clinton tried to take on the gays in the military issue in 93, we started seeing 93, 94, a few of the most popular television series start to have gay-themed episodes. So, for instance, Seinfeld would have There's Nothing Wrong With That episode, for instance. Roseanne would have gay characters. So we had these one-shot episodes, and there wasn't significant backlash from these. So we started to see background characters start to emerge around 1995. And we saw the number of recurring characters that were gay and lesbian double in that year, from nothing to almost nothing. But more and more LGBTQ characters became sort of these background, these friends of the main character type thing, 95 and 96. And one of those shows was actually Ellen DeGeneres' show, These Friends of Mine. Now, Ellen's character was not out at the start of that show, but she had a friend that was gay. And it was Ellen's show in 1995 that marked the beginning of a lesbian lead or a character that was a lesbian lead. So we started to see more and more prominent depictions of LGBTQ people occur over the course of the 1990s on television. We had, by the end of the 1990s, we had supporting characters. Dawson's Creek had a character, Jack McPhee. We had on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a lot of these shows that were targeted towards millennials, for instance, had Willow, who was LGBTQ. So if you were, you know, watching a moderate amount of television, it would be very hard not to encounter at least one LGBTQ person over the course of the 1990s.
Jeremiah Gerritsen teaches political science at California State University East Bay, and his book is The Path to Gay Rights: How Activism and Coming Out Changed Public Opinion. We'll take a short break and speak more with Jeremiah about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Jeremiah Gerritsen joins me in studio. He is Assistant Professor of Political Science at California State University, East Bay. And his book, his very interesting book, is The Path to Gay Rights: How Activism and Coming Out Changed Public Opinion. So are you interested in the growing number of media portrayals of LGBTQ people? Because of the phenomenon such as people watching these programs are more likely to come out, or because people who are viewing these programs who are heterosexual learn something from these characters and these episodes and these shows that might have an effect on their attitudes toward LGBTQ issues?
That's a very good question, and actually both. I think LGBTQ people, especially younger LGBTQ people in the 1990s, they saw these shows, they saw these characters, and they felt less stigma. But also, I've been talking a lot about intergroup contact and how intergroup contact with LGBTQ people can affect people's attitudes and did affect people's attitudes. But for people that don't meet LGBTQ people, it turns out that if they see an LGBTQ character, especially one that they relate to, one that they have what we call a parasocial relationship or sort of a little bit of a psychological relationship with, even though it's one-sided, that interaction, even though it's a virtual interaction, even though it's a mediated interaction, that can affect someone's attitudes in a similar way to having a gay friend or a gay family member or a gay acquaintance. Interacting with a television character or following a television character that you emotionally relate to, and that's the key, you have to emotionally relate to that character, can have a similar effect, almost an identical effect on someone's attitudes as having a gay friend or having a gay family member. It was really interpersonal contact along with these LGBTQ television characters that really transformed the public. In fact, if you look at individuals from the 1980s, when there wasn't a lot of intergroup contact, to the 1990s, the late 1990s specifically, if you look at people who report never knowing anyone that's LGBTQ, in the 1980s, those people are fairly anti-gay. In fact, younger people in the 1980s are actually more anti-gay than older people if they don't know anyone that's LGBTQ. Fast forward to the late 90s. What happened as all of these LGBTQ characters started to proliferate on television in the mid-90s and late 90s, the people that didn't know LGBTQ people, their attitudes began to resemble those that did. And the most prominent way to illustrate this is to look at whether younger people are more supportive. And you find that in the late 1990s, among people that don't have any interpersonal contact with LGBTQ people, younger people shift significantly more supportive. And younger people's attitudes come to resemble those people that do report interpersonal contact. And I show in a number of analyses in the book that this is linked to television consumption, that it's viewing LGBTQ television characters that made younger people more supportive of gay rights in the late 1990s if they didn't have interpersonal contact.
And why would younger people respond more positively to TV depictions of the kind that we were talking about?
So I have a theory that I develop in the book that I call effective liberalization, and it implicates what we call affect. Affect is sort of a gut reaction that you have towards a person or a social group, positivity or negativity. You don't quite know where it comes from, but you kind of feel it instantaneously. So for instance, if I were to say Barack Obama, or if I were to say Donald Trump, some individuals are going to have instantaneous positivity or negativity towards those individuals. It's the same with social groups. So the interesting thing is among younger people, they haven't encountered these social groups or members of these social groups, so they don't really have that initial feeling, that initial affect. It hasn't formed or crystallized in them. It's through learning about these groups or interacting with them that affect starts to form and crystallize. Now, throughout the AIDS crisis and prior, older individuals, when they encountered LGBTQ people, it's always in a negative sense. Sinful, they're unhealthy, they're dangerous, they're spreading disease, they're linked to communists in the 1950s. It was all this negativity surrounding LGBTQ people. And that negativity crystallized in older people's attitudes in the form of this subconscious affect, this negativity. So when older people in the 1990s met someone that was LGBTQ or saw them on television, they get this ick factor, this negativity that would instantly come up. But for younger people, they didn't have that feeling. So when younger people started seeing positive depictions of LGBTQ people on television, or they started meeting LGBTQ friends or family members in the late 1990s, that would initially form positive affect for the next encounter. So these positive interactions started to become sort of encoded in people's subconscious. And it was really that encoding in the subconscious that made younger people, especially millennials, much more positive.
What about exposure to TV news about and sympathetic toward gay rights? Does exposure to that kind of news have the same effect on younger people's attitudes toward gay rights as does fictional TV, as does interpersonal contact?
I don't think it does. I think it does have an effect. But I think that effect is more temporary. So for instance, it's when you're watching the news, you know, it's kind of like, you know, studying, it's kind of like a little bit of work, which can be a little difficult. And you have to expend mental energy. You have to think about, you know, the news. So let's say you study for a math test. You spend a month studying for a math test. You take the math test. You do very well. Well, if you spontaneously have to take that math test again 3 months later, are you going to do well on it? Well, you're probably not going to, because you're going to forget a lot of the stuff you learned for the math test the first time. And this is how one of our brain's decision-making systems work, our conscious decision-making. So if we're making decisions based on information, we have to retain that information. We have to remember the news story that we saw. The interesting thing about intergroup contact as to why it has durable effects, according to my theory, is that it has durable effects by working on people's subconscious, that it has effects by working on these instantaneous gut reactions, these emotional reactions that we have towards these social outgroups. So news stories can affect, I think, attitudes in the short term. But when people forget the news story a few months later or a few weeks later, their attitudes revert back. Because people's emotional gut reactions don't revert back when you forget about the interaction, because they're encoded in your brain a little bit more, in a little bit more of a durable fashion, intergroup contact has much more durable effects than news stories.
Okay, so perhaps for those listeners who just joined us fairly recently, could you kind of sum up your argument as to, again, why mass attitudes toward LGBTQ people and issues changed so dramatically from the period, let's say, from the late 80s to the year 2000?
Well, it starts with the AIDS crisis. The AIDS crisis caused this intense wave of activism among LGBTQ people, particularly in the form of the organization ACT UP. They really assaulted the news media to normalize coverage of first AIDS and then LGBTQ issues. And it was this coverage, this news coverage of LGBTQ issues, that started to make LGBTQ people across the country feel more comfortable sharing themselves with others. It started to reduce the stigma of being LGBTQ. It also led, this initial coverage of LGBTQ issues led to the proliferation of LGBTQ television characters also, which also affected mass opinion. So it was really two things that produced the bulk of the attitude change that we saw towards LGBTQ people. The boom in coming out that was caused by press coverage of LGBTQ issues, the increase in coming out over the course of the 1990s of individual LGBTQ people across the country, and to a lesser extent, for people that didn't interact with LGBTQ people or meet them in person, those people that viewed LGBTQ television characters. Those were really the two things that durably changed public opinion.
What about the belief that people are born gay and therefore can't be blamed for choosing to be gay? Does adopting that belief on the part of a heterosexual, say, have a comparable effect on that person's likelihood that he or she will develop more tolerant attitudes toward LGBTQ people?
That's a very that was a very serious counterargument, and I actually have a co-author, Elizabeth Suey, at American University, that we published two studies on this specific belief. So we call this attribution theory, that if individuals that are born gay are gay due to biological reasons, you know, normatively it's not their fault, and I'm using air quotes right now, that they're gay, so they shouldn't be punished or discriminated against for those reasons. That still presumes that if it, you know, if they, someone chose to be gay, they should still be condemned, which, you know, is a little morally tenuous. But, you know, let's push that aside for a second. What we did is we find that this is actually a consistent argument if you look at the historical data. But about 2 or 3 years ago, we actually did a survey experiment where we had individuals in a nationally represented survey. We had a third of the individuals read nothing. A third of the individuals read a short paragraph just describing that there were some scientific studies that found that individuals were born gay for biological reasons. And then we had another short paragraph that a third of our respondents got, where we said the scientific evidence actually says the opposite, that people choose to be gay, that sexuality is fluid, things like that. And what we wanted to see is if people read a little bit of a description of scientific evidence that people are born gay, would they become more pro-gay, and would that be caused by people adopting this belief that people are born gay? We actually found that the people that read the paragraph compared to the people that read nothing, that described the scientific information, they got a little bit pro-gay, but it wasn't because they adopted this belief that gays were born gay. So the conclusion that we came to is that this biological attribution doesn't appear to move around people's gay rights attitudes. That when people start to adopt that belief in the presence of scientific information, their gay rights attitudes don't really change. Here's what we actually think is going on. We looked a lot at the variable of ideology of liberalism, liberal to conservatism, because, you know, liberals kind of want to be pro-gay in the current climate because they view gays and lesbians as being sort of allied to liberals. And what we were finding was that liberals who were reading this information were disproportionately adopting the belief that gays were born gay. At the same time, they were getting a little bit more pro-gay. So it looked like liberalism was actually causing both of those beliefs, individuals to sort of reason that causing individuals to kind of support gay rights more, but also to kind of back reason a little bit and to believe that gays are born gay because of their liberalism, because they wanted to support gay rights.
Jeremiah Gerritsen is my guest in studio. He teaches political science at California State University, East Bay, and we are talking about his book, The Path to Gay Rights, How Activism and Coming Out Changed Public Opinion. It's published by NYU Press. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in one chapter of your book, you extend your analysis outside the U.S., have the major factors that you've identified as changing attitudes in the U.S., have those factors been at play abroad?
Yes, definitely. In fact, if you look out across the globe and you look for countries that have very well-developed media systems and also countries that have free speech rights ingrained into their society, where unpopular minorities can go to the press and try to get their story out and have that story disseminated, for instance, by having lots of televisions in a country or lots of newspapers or things like that, you actually find that those countries, which are mostly Western liberal countries, but also countries in Latin America, some in the Asian Rim, those countries have all experienced the same structure of attitude change of younger people growing much more liberal, everyone growing more liberal on gay rights overall, but younger people being at the forefront of those changes. So it seems that if you have a country that has free speech and that has a pervasive media system where an oppressed minority can get their message out, it was fairly universal that those countries all saw shifts much more positive towards LGBTQ people. So that's why we saw changes in Western Europe. And the timeline is, for the most part, across most countries, very similar, where we see shifts in the 1990s after the AIDS crisis hit. So it appears the data are consistent with what happened in the U.S. happening in these other countries. But you need to have free speech. You need to have freedom of the press. You need to have a pervasive media system for these effects to happen. If you have a country that's very rich, that has a well-developed media system, but there's no freedom of the press, you don't see attitude change on LGBTQ issues.
So we've really addressed activism or talked about activism in the context of ACT UP and the activism in response to the AIDS crisis. And certainly there's been a lot of LGBTQ activism over the years in many venues, in many forms. And I guess you could say that increasing depictions on TV of LGBTQ characters is a form of activism. But I guess I'm wondering how important you think grassroots activism, sustained grassroots activism, is to getting people to change their beliefs.
I think sustained grassroots activism is crucial, especially at the local level, at the interpersonal level, to changing people's beliefs. I'm going to talk about some subsequent work that I've been doing really quick because, you know, I got interested in looking at other shifts in attitudes that we've seen. So, for instance, attitudes towards marijuana legalization have shifted about as much as LGBTQ issues over the last decade. We've seen actually support for gun control shrink a little with the exception of the last 2 years since Parkland. Over that time, we've seen support for immigrants' rights expand considerably over the last 10 years. So I started to look at whether sort of my model of public opinion change could apply to these other issues. And what I was finding was that individuals who report that they have friends that use marijuana are actually much more liberal in terms of marijuana legalization, if they're young, as compared to older people. I'm finding that individuals who report contact with undocumented immigrants are actually much more tolerant towards undocumented immigrants if they're young compared to older people. I'm finding actually that opposition to gun control, oddly enough, in a conservative direction, whereas these other attitudinal shifts have been more liberal, that individuals who who are very young and have a gun owner in their household that isn't them are actually more conservative in terms of their beliefs in terms of whether they think that gun sales should be restricted or things like that. So it looks like these attitude change processes, if you start to see changes in polling data, aggregate polling data, and you try to trace them back to the cause, it appears that this destigmatization of certain behaviors or certain beliefs and the increasing propensity of people to share themselves and their beliefs and their preferences with others in their interpersonal environment with their friends and family member, that undergirds a lot of what we think of as social change. And by social change here, I mean shifts in a society in the preferences, in their collective preferences, where young people are at the forefront of that shift. So on marijuana, gun control, gay rights, immigration, it appears that when people consume media who are undocumented people, who are marijuana users, who are gun enthusiasts, LGBTQ, when they see media that makes them feel more comfortable sharing themselves with others, and when they share themselves with their friends and family, that's what causes social change.
Yeah, fascinating, because we always hear about like organizing and people acting in a collective way to change things. And what you're talking about really is the power of interpersonal contact and the power of one person's decision to open up, in this case, come out to other people.
Mm-hmm. And it's when the media causes a whole bunch of people to open up to their friends and to their family members all at the same time, that's when we see public opinion change. That's when we see younger people start to diverge in their attitudes as compared to their parents.
So what do your findings suggest for the future of gay rights in the U.S.?
So there's optimism and then there's pessimism here. In the short term, I think a lot of people are very pessimistic with this current administration. We know that, for instance, the current Congress is not going to advance an anti-discrimination bill that says that you can't fire people for being LGBTQ or something like that. In the long run, I'm much more optimistic that the changes that we've seen with the millennial generation and now the post-millennial generation, that because those positive attitudes are sort of encoded in people's subconscious, we're not going to see attitudes revert back, except maybe in a very marginal fashion, a couple percentage points, that there's that emotional positivity is not going to evaporate overnight. And that said, I have to return to the short term a little bit in terms of my natural pessimism, because we have seen an increased attack on some members of the LGBTQ community, especially transgendered individuals. We're seeing legal attacks. We're seeing conservative politicians, religious politicians put forth these bathroom bills in terms of scapegoating. So there is a danger, especially for the most marginal members of the LGBTQ people, trans people, queer and trans people of color, for instance, that we need to be on the lookout and very vigilant in the LGBTQ movement over the next few years. But I think the long-term support, the long-term trends beyond this current presidential administration are very good.
Jeremiah Gerritsen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at California State University, East Bay. And his new book is The Path to Gay Rights, How Activism and Coming Out Changed Public Opinion. Thanks for this book, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.